ever feel like you're taking one step forward and two steps backwards? Chuck Swindoll, several years ago, wrote a book entitled Three Steps Forward and Two Steps Backwards. And the basis of the book was that life is not all about the mountaintop experiences. It's often far more about persistency than it is excitement. But even that book has the idea that I'm taking three steps forward and only two backwards. But be honest. This past week, did it seem like you took one step forward and two steps back? My guess is that if you're thinking that, you're sitting there thinking, yeah, but nobody else thinks that. I'm the only one who had a bad week. I'm the only one who had a lousy week. That's common only to me. May I suggest that's not the case? If you were with us last week, we were on the mountaintop, if you will. We were in Luke chapter 9, and we went with Peter, James, and John as they had the incredible privilege to see Jesus transfigured. He was metamorphosized into who he really is, and his glory shone through. But do you remember who was with him? There were two Old Testament characters. There was Moses and Elijah. Can I go back to their lives just for a quick second? If you remember Moses, Moses was this incredible figure that God used to really make the nation of Israel from a family into a nation. He was the one that God gave the law to. In fact, we talk about the Mosaic Law. He was considered in Hebrew history as perhaps the greatest leader Israel will ever have. He had this incredible experience after bringing the nation of Israel out of Egypt through these incredible plagues and finally crossing the Red Sea. They come to the Sinai Peninsula and Moses has this chance to go up on the mountain. And for 40 days, he's in the very presence of God. He talks to God. God talks to him. He has this chance to have this conversation, much like I would guess most of us wish we could have. It was an incredible experience. And God does something for Moses that he's never done before and never done after. He takes a set of stone tablets and with his own finger, he writes on it the Ten Commandments. And he gives it to Moses. And after 40 days, Moses, carrying this most precious of material that could never be replaced, he walks down, and as he gets to the bottom of the mountain, Joshua is there. And Joshua says, it sounds like there's war in the camp. And Moses says, it's not war. And he goes down, and in chapter 32 of Exodus, he sees what has happened. The children of Israel have decided they're not wanting to worship the God who brought them out of Egypt. They want their own God. They want a God they can see. And so they convinced Aaron to take their gold and to make this calf, and they're bowing down and worshiping this calf, and it's a drunken orgy. And Moses does what? He becomes so enraged, he smashes the only thing God ever touched. He goes up again, and God says, not this time, Moses. I'm not going to write it. You are. Let me go forward to Elijah. Elijah, the second individual that was on the mountain with Jesus, was without question one of the great prophets, although not a writing prophet. He had this incredible chance to speak for God. And as we open the story of Elijah, he enters the throne room of Ahab and says, it will not rain until I say it will. And then 3.5 years pass. Just try and figure that out just for a second. We're weeks away from the beginning of the planting season in Iowa. Imagine if it didn't rain until the fall of 2013. The next time it rained would be 4 harvests later. Can you imagine what our society would be like? It would be devastated, all because Elijah said it wouldn't rain. And finally, Elijah comes back and he says, I'm ready for it to rain, but we need to have this confrontation. And they go up to the mountaintop on Mount Carmel, and he has this confrontation with the prophets of Baal. You bring down fire. They can't bring down fire. And he prays, and God sends this amazing fire, and it consumes his sacrifice. And then he turns to the people and says, all right, those guys over there, kill them all. And all of the prophets of Baal are stoned. And then Elijah goes up and he prays, and God sends rain. And for the first time in 3.5 years, it rains. And it has to be such an experience. But what happens next? Jezebel finds out and says, I'm going to kill you. And Elijah, the prophet of God, runs out into the desert. And in the desert, he becomes discouraged, depressed, and says, I would like divine suicide, please. God, kill me. It's not worth living. Elijah, Moses, and the disciples. If you have your Bible, would you go with me back to the Gospel of Luke? We're looking at this incredible story in which we're going to see this mountaintop experience. The painter, Raphael, one of the greatest Western painters, his final painting was a painting of Luke chapter 9. And I think he, in graphic form, does such an incredible chance to capture what's going on here. He begins by painting this incredible picture of the Christ being transfigured. But as you pan down, he, at the very bottom of the hill, has a completely different picture. It's the picture of the demon-possessed boy. If you look off to the side, you see that boy. And as you look at the whole, you get a picture of what's going on here. It's not just the glory of Christ. It's not just the mountaintop of life. It's the realities that follow. So this morning, as we continue our study through the Gospel of Luke, looking at this man who is God, we come to Luke chapter 9, and I believe we're going to see the disciples taking, if you will, one step forward and four steps backwards. We pick up the story after this, the next day, when they had came down from the mountain, a great crowd met them, and behold, a man from the crowd cried out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. For he is my only son, and behold, his spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and shatters him, and will hardly leave him. And I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." Jesus answered, "Oh, you faithless and twisted generations, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring me your son." While he was coming, the demon threw him to the ground and convulsed him, but Jesus rebuked the unclean spirits and healed the boy and gave him back to the father, and all were astonished at his majesty. Let me just quickly go through this story, because there's four stories, four vignettes, if you will, that Luke takes. And if you want a longer account, you can go to Luke's or Matthew's account or Mark's account. They give us more detail, but Luke is just sharing a condensed version of these stories, because I think his point is not so much to give all the details, but there is the point that after the mountaintops, failure often follows. And as we begin, it's the next day. This is the following day. Jesus and Peter, James, and John were on the mountaintop, and they come down. And as they come down, they begin to hear a discussion. Mark tells us that there were Pharisees there, and they were arguing with the disciples. "You said you're followers of Jesus. A lot of good that does. You can't even cast out this demon." "Yeah, you claim to have power. We all see that. What kind of power?" And they're arguing back and forth. And as they're arguing, suddenly Luke pans to the face of this son, this father, who cries out. If you've been around a father, a mother, whose children have significant health issues, there are few things that will tear one's heart out faster than watching a child suffer. I was a bit surprised. I get weekly pastoral updates from Chuck Swindoll. He sends them out. And I know a little bit about Chuck's life, not a great deal. But in this week, he was sharing that his daughter gave birth to an autistic child. And he was sharing how that autism has dramatically changed his life and certainly the life of his daughter. And my guess is that every single one of us here have either experienced it or have been around somebody who is going through it. And to see the pain of a parent who is enduring this unending physical problem has to be terrifying. And as you begin to see the picture that's painted, this boy is demon-possessed and has been since birth. Mark tells us that he's deaf and dumb, so he can't cry out. And the spirit that's in possessing him will throw him into the fire, and he's not able to scream. He'll throw him into the water, trying to drown him. And the father, imagine the father's anguish, having to constantly have his eye on the boy, because he never knows what this demon's going to do. And he brings him to the disciples, and he says, "Cast out the demon," and they can't. And as the disciples and the Pharisees are arguing, he doesn't care. He just wants help. And so he cries out to Jesus. And he says, "Teacher, I beg you, look at my son." And as Jesus looks at the son and the demon throws him on the ground, suddenly Jesus says this, "Oh, faithless and twisted generation." Who is he talking to? Some have suggested he was talking to the father. I mean, after all, the father must have had some faith issues or his son wouldn't be possessed by a demon, right? I don't think that's the case. We're going to see in a second that the father was, in fact, the one who did have faith. In fact, it's a fascinating story. We're going through Sunday school. We're talking about fishing. We're talking about sharing our faith. And oftentimes we struggle. I don't know, I have all the answers. I don't know what the right thing to say is. There is perhaps no better illustration of lousy fishing and still catching a fish. The disciples did everything wrong, and yet God pulls him to Jesus. I don't think it's the Father. Could be the entire society. Could be talking to the Pharisees. But I would suggest, I think his primary point is to the disciples. Why do I say that? Well, if you jump back up to verse 1 of chapter 9, Jesus says this to them as he's sending them out. He called the 12 together and he gave them power and authority over most of the demons except the really stubborn ones. It's not what it says. It says he gave them power over all demons. Even the tough ones. They didn't believe. What is faith? I'm afraid we throw faith around often, and sometimes it's easy to begin to think of this as this immaterial force that moves mountains, as it were. But I would suggest that faith is simply the willingness to take God at His word, even, or maybe especially, when it doesn't look like it makes sense. I tried, it didn't work. I just can't believe that that is really possible. I just don't get it. But before we get too hard on the disciples, be honest. You ever been there? I will never leave you nor forsake you, God says. You ever felt alone? I will supply all your needs according to my glorious riches in heaven. You ever thought your need is too big? I will make you fishers of men. Oh, not me. Sorry, God. That's too big of a task. I don't have all the answers. I never went to Bible college or seminary like the pastor. I just am not an outgoing folk. I don't talk to strangers. Do we really believe God when He speaks? I love the way that the Father is described. If you go back to Luke, you will find that there's this discourse that goes between Jesus and the Father. And He says, if you're able, Jesus, please cast him out. And Jesus says, if I'm able, all things are possible for those who believe. And the Father says this, I believe. Help my unbelief. May I suggest it doesn't matter how much faith you have. It doesn't matter how good a faith you have. It's not a quantity or quality issue. It's an object issue. I remember when I was in India, Dr. Ironside preached a sermon from Exodus 14. It was on the Passover, and he shared the story of two boys. The first boy was in a slave's home. He was a Jew. And he stood back and he watched as the father took a lamb and cut the throat of the lamb and captured the blood. And then they cooked the lamb and they ate all the lamb. And then the father took the blood and he painted on the doorpost. And he came in and he told his family that God is going to send his death angel tonight. And he is going to take the firstborn of every family in all of Egypt except those who have their doorposts painted with blood. And the son wondered, was this a spotless enough lamb? Did we do it right? Did we paint enough of the door? Did we eat enough of the lamb? Did we do everything right? And all night he couldn't sleep as he wondered, did we do it right? And then he went to the house of Pharaoh. And the story of the death angel had reached Pharaoh's house. And the son of the Pharaoh thought, death angel, I serve Ra. Look at my God. Look at the grandeur and the glory of what He has built. I'm not going to worry about those slaves, God. I am perfectly secure and safe and had amazing faith in His God. In the morning, one was alive and one was dead. One had great faith. One's faith struggled. One faith was in Ra. The other in the only true God. The boy's father said, I believe. Please help my unbelief. This morning it's not about how much faith you have, but who do you have faith in? The disciples, their faith wasn't in the right place. their faith evidently was in themselves. And later, as they see this, God comes back and he talks about this, and he takes his son after he casts out the demon. And I love this imagery, this incredible kindness. You see this, the Jairus, when the widow of Nain and Jairus, their children passed away, and Jesus comes and raised them from the dead. You have this phrase of Jesus gives them back to their father, to their mother. Jesus takes the boy who in Mark tells us everybody thought was dead, and he picks the boy up and he lovingly gives it back. And everyone was absolutely astonished. And I love the way it's stated here. They were astonished at the majesty. What just happened in the previous chapter? If you were here last week, what happened last week? The disciples had the chance to see the majesty of Christ. And they were on the mountaintop. We're now in the valley. And yet the majesty of Christ is as visible in the hard times as it is in the good times. Mark shares that later that day, the disciples were alone with Jesus in a house, and they entered the house and they asked Jesus privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind can be driven out, cannot be driven out by anything but prayer." I don't remember Jesus praying. Remember Jesus praying? Go back and read Matthew 17, Mark 9, Luke 9. See if you find that when the boy comes, Jesus says, "Just a second, time out here. I got to go pray. I'll be back in an hour. Let me pray." Well, okay, so he didn't have an hour. But right before he cast it out, he said a prayer, right? No place in there where you read Jesus prayed. So is Jesus being a hypocrite? You guys have to pray, not me. May I suggest, do you remember what Jesus did all night the night before? Jesus was praying all night the night of his transfiguration. I don't think Jesus is saying that this kind of demon, if you're going to cast it out, you've got to have this ritual where you stop and you say these words and you pray this prayer, and some of the texts say, and you fast. And so you say, "I'm not going to do it for an hour." That's not the point. Prayer is the clearest illustration of my willingness to depend upon God, because in prayer I'm saying, "I can't, but you can. I don't understand, but you do. I don't get it, but you do." Prayer is my willingness to humble myself and say, "God, I know that you know. I know that you can, and I am convinced I can't." And what Jesus is saying is prayer is the life of faith. It's not that I pray at the moments of hardship, but rather that I pray all the time. And when the hardships come, I'm ready. Jesus says that they only come out by faith. The disciples blew it. They were a faithless generation. But secondly, not only did they have the failure of faith, as you continue, I love the way Luke says this, but while they were all marveling, while the whole crowd was excited and enthused and consumed by the majesty of God, Jesus turns to his disciples and he says, "Let these words sink into your ears." Don't listen to them. Don't get caught up in the euphoria of the moment. These words are the ones you need to hear. "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men." Peter, a few days earlier, probably about a week earlier, has declared and confessed that Jesus is the Christ of God. And when he does, Jesus says, "All right, great, Peter, but I want you to know that I'm suffering, dying, and on the third day will rise from the dead." Jesus is saying, "I don't want you to get caught up in this. I want you to understand that in a few days, those guys who are praising me will be killing me." And then we read, "But they did not understand this saying. And it was concealed from them so that they might not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about it." They didn't get it. Why? Why didn't they get it? Well, there's two possible answers, and I'm not sure I'm convinced of which one is right, so let me throw them both out. The first is, some would suggest that God kept it from them. That he understood that they wouldn't be able to deal with it, and if you go to the Last Supper, he tells them again, and finally they get it, and what do? They take off and they run away. And some would suggest that God kept them from being able to understand it because they couldn't deal with it. And that's certainly possible, and it would speak of God's kindness. But Luke throws this expression in. He says, they were afraid to ask about this saying. Have you ever not wanted to know something? You're going someplace. You're running a little bit behind. You come to a new town you've never been through. Isn't it convenient if you really don't know the speed limit? Sorry, officer, I thought it was 55. I didn't realize it was 25. I come home and there's a cake sitting on the counter. Must be for me. I mean, Renee obviously must love me so much she made a cake for me. And rather than asking, I don't want to know if it's for somebody else. I just see the cake. Thanks, Renee. Oh, it was for somebody else. Sorry, I didn't know. Aren't there times when you don't want to know things? And so you don't pursue them, you just go through ignorance is bliss. Maybe that's it, but Matthew gives another hint. My brother-in-law served as a pastor in a small church up in the Minneapolis area for about 10 years, and while he was there, he started volunteering as a fireman. And that volunteering as a fireman got him into the chaplain row of the Blaine Police Department. Blaine is one of the northern suburbs, and he has since gone on full-time with the fire departments, and his roles involve both fireman and chaplain. One of the biggest roles as chaplain is he does almost all of the death notices in Blaine. When somebody's killed in a car accident, he's the one that goes knocks on the door and says, I'm sorry, your son, your daughter was killed in a car accident. When they find a suicide, he's the one who goes to the home and says, I'm sorry, your son or your daughter has committed suicide. And he shares that it is amazing how people react. In the moment of grief, most of the time, the initial response is, oh, no, no, not my child. I just talked to them 5 minutes ago. It can't be my son. It can't be my daughter. It can't be my dad. It can't be my husband, my wife. It must be somebody else. It can't be. And the first huge hurdle almost everybody has to get over is grief brings denial. I don't want to believe it. And Matthew hints at the fact that they were grieved at this statement. And I think there's the very strong possibility that they just simply refused to believe it. That's not the way it's going to work, Jesus. I don't know what this death you're talking about is. I don't understand what you mean. You're going to suffer and be rejected and die. I don't get any of that, but I know it can't be true. So just stop talking about it. And they fail to understand. And then they continue, and Luke shares a third story in which an argument among them arose as to which of them was the greatest. Now, this is just, when you read it, it seems humorous. We are days, maybe only hours, after the transfiguration. Last week in the Go Fish series, Andy Stanley used the illustration that this is like two ants arguing in front of an elephant. Who's the greatest? And the elephant says, from here, you both look like ants. And that might be it, but let me try and suggest it might have worked something like this. In the first century, most of the way you traveled was down very narrow paths, sometimes because of the geography, sometimes because there was only a small path, and as a rule, you walked in single file lines. The rabbi was always ahead, and disciples, quite literally, were followers. And so you would walk in the dust of the rabbi. And I can just imagine they've now had this incredible day in which Peter, James, and John have gone up to the mountain, and as they're walking on this way, Andrew says to Peter, what'd you guys do up in the mountain? Nothing. Well, tell me what went on. Can't. What do you mean you can't tell me? You forgot? No, I just can't tell you. Why can't you tell me? Well, if you have to know, it's because Jesus told me I couldn't. Why did he tell you that? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? I'm the leader. You're not. You're not smart enough to get it. What do you mean I'm not smart enough to get it? You're the one who sticks your foot in your mouth. No, no, no. Jesus chose me. I'm the one he chose, not you. You're dumb. You're stupid. You're not nearly as important as I am. And I can just imagine this argument going back and forth. And I love the way Mark describes it. They get to the house and they sit down. They put their smiles on. And Jesus says, what were you guys talking about on the way here? We weren't talking about anything. We were arguing over who is the greatest. How do you decide greatness? It's interesting to me. Jesus doesn't rebuke them for desiring to be excellent. God has put in all of us a desire to do well. He doesn't stop that. What he does is he tries to illustrate an incredibly important point. He grabs a child. Let me just take you back to the first century. Children were loved. But in the first century, children had a different role. Children were to be seen, not heard. Children were in the role of honoring their parents, and they got no honor. They were treated like a slave, because that's what they were. A child was taken by Jesus. You remember the disciples didn't get this very well. In fact, when the children came up and sat on Jesus' laps, what do? Get away, get away. No, he doesn't have time for you. We don't want to have you around. You're not important enough to take his time, because that's the way children were viewed in the first century. But Jesus takes a child and he takes him into his lap and he says, whoever receives this child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For whoever is least among you is the greatest. What's Jesus trying to say? In Mark, he states it a little more carefully. He says, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. Our society, as with the Jews, determined greatness by how many people serve and worship them. The most powerful people in our society are the ones who have the most people serving them. We do not view the important people as the ones who serve the most. A.J. Cronin was a doctor in England and gave way to literature and has written a number of novels, and almost all of them are on the subject of medicine. In one of his novels, he shares the story of a nurse who lived and worked in rural England. And she was in a very poor area, and she was most often the one who met with all of the medical needs of that community. Only on rare occasions did somebody get a chance to see an actual doctor. And she would get up in the middle of the night and go to these emergencies. And she was woefully, inadequately paid. On one particular occasion, as she was roused in the middle of the night to go to a traumatic experience, she was coming out as the doctor went in. And as she came out, the doctor said, why don't you make them pay you more? God knows you're worth it. To which she responded, if God knows it, that's all that matters to me. Is that true of you? If God knows I'm worth it, I don't really care what others think, or even what I receive in this life. The reality is we don't honor servants like we should. I want to challenge you to do something. Before you go home this morning, would you do me a favor? Right now, behind the glass windows are a couple people caring for babies. They're holding the babies largely so you and I can have an undisturbed worship area, worship time. Downstairs, there's some people teaching kids at their level. Before the worship service this morning, there were a number of individuals who gave up time this week to study and came and shared Christ in a way that kids can understand. On Wednesday night, this place is exploding with energy as there are dozens of tireless kids with exhausted adults following them who would just as soon, like you and I, be home, sitting in front of the television, relaxing, but have decided, no, I will go serve. We have Pastor Appreciation Sunday, and I appreciate it. I thank you for your kind words to me, and you all have been incredibly kind, but I want to challenge you before you go this morning, say thank you to somebody who's serving the kids. In fact, even if you don't have kids, say thank you to somebody who's serving. Serving the least is where Christ calls us the greatest. But the Pharisees fail it. And one final failure, he says, John, I want to stop there for a second. Peter gets a bad name. Peter's the one who's always sticking his foot in his mouth. And my guess is if you were going to say which disciple sticks his foot in his mouth the most, you would instantly go to Peter. But may I suggest Not always, but the vast majority of the time, any disciple opens his mouth, he sticks his foot in his mouth. This time, it's not Peter. Thank you. It's not Peter. It's John. John says, as they couldn't cast out the demon, and they're trying to figure out this whole, who do we serve? John says, well Jesus, let's change the subject. Yesterday, I was out, and I saw somebody casting out a demon. He isn't part of us. So I stopped him. Because obviously, if he isn't part of us, he's wrong, right? He doesn't look like me, dress like me, talk like me. There's something wrong with him. You know, there's two ways in life, the right way and the wrong way, and I certainly would never choose the wrong way. And so if you're doing it different than I am, well, I guess we don't have to discuss what you're doing. You're doing it wrong. Be honest. When somebody does something different than you, is it easy to say they're just different? Or is this the incredible temptation to say they're wrong? When I had a chance to go to Israel, I traveled with primarily Presbyterian ministers. And one of the things almost all of them did before they came home is they had to buy a prayer shawl. Because every Sunday they wear a robe with a prayer shawl. And clearly God condemns that, right? I mean, that's wrong! Isn't it? God's word can't be taught from behind a robe, can it? It's easy for me, having grown up particularly in the circles that I grew up in, which they were very conservative, to instantly think if somebody's different, they must be wrong. They're not part of us, Jesus, they're wrong. And Jesus says, you're right, where are they at? Let me go curse them. Let me bring down some fire. I'll stop them. Is that what he says? No, he says, do not stop him. For anyone who's not against you is for you. Think about that for a second. Is that the way you view people? Anybody who's not against you is on your side. It's not the way that comes natural to me. I want everybody to do everything that I do. Not, okay, they're different. That must be okay. The disciples fail and they fail and they fail and they fail. And if I'm honest, I fail and I fail. And if you're honest, you fail and you fail. And so let's all go home miserable and discouraged, right? The point of the sermon this morning is to help you understand that you're going to have a miserable life. Just get used to it. Thankfully, no. There was a verse in there that really struck me. When Jesus decries the faithlessness of the generation, he ends it by saying, how long do I have to be with you and bear with you? And yet, you know what he does? He never gives up on them. Never. For the next year, Jesus is going to turn away from the crowds and he's going to center his energy on those same disciples that failed time and time and time again. And Jesus, with amazing love and amazing patience, is going to be right there and encourage them. And when he dies, and when he rises again, and they still don't get it, and he says, come on, Thomas, put your hands right here. And finally, in Acts chapter 1, he says to them, you are now ready. You are my witnesses. And they go out and they change the world. And we sit here this morning because God was patient with them. And may I suggest he's patient with me and with you. Not that we want to fail. But in the midst of our failure, he puts up with us. He bears with us. He loves us. And he's there to pick us up, to instruct us in the new way, and to lovingly help us every step of the way. I don't know where you're at this morning. You might be on a mountaintop. I hope you are. I hope this was the greatest week of your life and you were consumed with excitement and you saw God use you in amazing ways. But maybe that's not the case. My word to you is, it's okay. Christ still loves you. And as long as we are willing to return to him, he's always standing with open arms and saying, come to me, all you who are heavy, all you who are burdened down with life's struggles. My yoke is light, and I am ready for you. The question this morning is, will we return? Father, I bow in your presence, and Lord, I confess that I fail far too often. But I am so grateful that you are willing to forgive, that you are willing to accept, that you are willing to lovingly receive all of us, no matter our blunders, no matter our failures. that if we return, you have promised to receive us. And Father, I pray if there's one on the mountaintop this morning that you might encourage him, that you might encourage her, that you would drive them to another great week. But those in the valley, those down in the difficulties of life, I pray you would encourage them, that you would wrap them in your loving arms, that you would support them, and that they would see your love, that they would experience your touch, and once again, take that step forward, no matter how many steps backwards we've taken. Thank you for all you have done. Thank you for what you will do. For it's in your Son's holy and precious name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much for coming this morning.